It's a pleasure to welcome aboard former Congressman Bob Barr from the 7th District of Georgia. Congressman Barr is has had a long and very colorful career in Congress and in private life. And Congressman Barr is now launching Liberty Guard, which is a way by which we, the citizen, can get a sort of a report card on the ratings of our congressmen, our senators, and our representatives with regard to their support of initiatives of liberty. And Congressman Barr, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Chuck, good morning. Great to be with you. And it's a kind of bad introduction and some of the work that we're starting now in our launch of Liberty Guard. And, of course, any of your listeners, friends and associates, we welcome them to go to our website, www.libertyguard.org. But I'm very excited always to be on your show and talk about fundamental issues of liberty and constitutional government.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you're getting into this issue now, especially not only because of the midterm, but because there is a sense in the country that we're losing control of our government, that we are, in a sense, losing control of our own destinies as the government moves away from an understanding of basic functions of liberty and the Constitution. So talk a little bit, if you will, about Liberty Guard, because I think it's the sort of website that people ought to have in their regular, you know, headline here and look at on a daily basis. What do they find on Liberty Guard?
What they'll find on Liberty Guard is a website for an organization that is completely nonpartisan, even though I, of course, served in this as a Republican and run as a Republican and the Libertarian ticket in 2008. Liberty Guard and website are not have nothing to do with any political party. Of course, both you and I know that liberty is not a partisan issue. For example, right. In the scorecard that we've just released for U.S. members of the House and the Senate, I think people will maybe very surprised when they look at the when they look at the scorecard for Liberty Guard, because it's based on true liberty votes, not looking or conservative, liberal, or Democratic votes. And some members of Congress who people may think are very conservative don't rank terribly high in terms of their liberty. The main concern Liberty Guard have, as you say, is trying to get people to refocus and to focus on saving and restoring liberty. It is slipping away from us. And the motto, as it were, for Liberty Guard is to make liberty work in the real world. We're not interested in hypothetical issues. We're not interested in theoretical debates. We're interested in making liberty work and getting people to understand how their liberty in the real world is affected by what government is doing.
I think that more Americans, both liberal and conservative, are waking up to the fact that liberty is under siege today. And one of the issues that brought that to the fore is the NSA scandal, the fact that the NSA is now able to spy on tens of billions of Americans without the benefit of a FISA warrant for specific people. And that includes looking at people's emails and listening in on their phone calls. And sort of as an adjunct to that, you've got more federal agencies, particularly Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, gathering data on Americans' both private matters, their health, and entering it into these massive computers in Washington. So does Liberty Guard rate congressmen based upon their opposition to that?
They do, Chuck, and I'm very glad that you pointed out something that a lot of Americans don't realize, and that is what NSA does, the National Security Agency, truly does affect everyone in this country. It's no longer the case that the National Security Agency focuses only on national security threats or national security foreign intelligence, as they used to. What they are gathering and what their agencies are gathering, even as you indicated, Health and Human Services through mandates of Obamacare and its thirst for information, but the IRS as well, they are gathering up information on virtually every American, and NSA in particular, and we have not yet seen the end of this, as I know you know, Chuck, the NSA is in the process of building a massive facility out in Utah that will dramatically, increase its capability to gather information from all manner of electronic communications, whether they're cell phone communications or Facebook or Internet or Google. They are gathering all of this, not because they believe that every person is involved in terrorist or illegal activity, but their theory is, well, if we don't have all of this data maintained and databased, then whenever a threat does develop, we have no way of going back and putting all the pieces together. So they're gathering all of this without any court order, without any court supervision, without any public knowledge of exactly what they're doing. And it's very frightening when we get people to realize exactly what they're doing.
Okay, my guest is former Congressman Bob Barr. He's the chairman of Liberty Guard. Congressman Barr, you know, at the same time that they're gathering up this information on regular citizens and violating many amendments of the Constitution in the process, you've got situations like the Boston Marathon, Marathon bombing, where you had people who they didn't pay attention to, even after having been warned by the Russians that these people were connected to terrorism. They were allowed to come in this country as refugees, which is so in other words, you know, we have this gathering of information, but yet we don't have a system in place where our Department of Homeland Security and our agencies of government can properly evaluate and monitor and hopefully deport the foreigners who are here to do damage. So, there's an irony to that.
There really is, and you've pointed out something that that's been a problem for quite some time and is increasing, and that is whether we're talking about local law enforcement, state law enforcement, or federal law enforcement, or investigative agencies, they have become so enamored with and so focused on technology and gathering information that they are getting away from good, solid work. That is putting the pieces, the information together. We think simply because we gather all of this information and database it and have these fancy algorithms that will, you know, tell us something at some point in time, that we're protecting people and performing legitimate security functions. We're not. The Boston bomber case is a perfect example. The information was there. Our intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies had been alerted to these people by the Russians. There was information in the database. There was information on the ground, on the street. But we were focusing so much on simply gathering up all manner of information that we let it slip by. The good news in that case was the fact that there was a lot of information that once they went back after the incident and looked for it, they found it able in pretty short order to identify these terrorists and take them out. But the fact of the matter is that if we think that surrendering our civil liberties, our Fourth Amendment rights, and allowing government just to gather up willy-nilly all sorts of information that it's going to protect us, it's not. So we're getting neither security nor privacy.
And then, of course, they went in after it was too late for the people who were killed and maimed on that day. Bob, there's another phenomena occurring, which is that you've got a policing development. You've got national police forces developing in many federal agencies. Even apparently the U.S. Postal Service now has its own police arm, where you have people being on the federal level being armed and trained and getting SWAT training and ammunition and whatnot. And this seems to be a phenomenon that's across the board on the federal level with many agencies. And much of this material is being passed on to local police departments. We saw that in Ferguson, where you had this enormous overreaction with bombs and whatnot. Are you concerned about that from a position of liberty?
I am, because there is a very significant distinction between the mindset and the constitutional limitations that are placed on legitimate military, that is national security, military, armed forces operations, and domestic law enforcement. The Fourth Amendment to our Constitution, for example, which protects us, our home places, our private papers, our offices, that protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures, was designed specifically because the British Crown, prior to our independence, would issue broad-ranging writs of assistance that allowed the British military, that is, officers of the Crown, to go into people's houses and take what they wanted. So the Fourth Amendment was designed specifically to guard against that. Yet what we see developing nowadays here in our own country with the militarization of local police and getting federal military involved in domestic law enforcement is a serious blurring of that line. Because when you have our military operating legitimately overseas, they aren't bound by the Fourth Amendment, for example. They aren't bound by the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, which provide very significant protections here in this country against abusive government power. But if we start allowing the police in this country to have this mindset of the military with the military equipment, the military training, and so forth, then what we are seeing, and we saw this to some extent, you're absolutely correct, in Ferguson, we've seen it in other instances as well, where the police get this mentality that they are military and are not bound by the normal constitutional restrictions that they otherwise would be bound by. So it's a phenomenon that's been growing over the years, but particularly since 2001, since 9/11. And it's not just the military equipment, it's the mindset that comes with that that is so dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob Barr, I want to thank you for joining me. Liberty Guard, I hope to have you on from time to time to talk about this, and I intend to discuss it quite often. Thank you very much, sir. All right, take care. All right, that's
Bye.
Bob Barr. He is with the Liberty Lobby. That's an older group. He is a Liberty Guard. It's the Liberty Guard Congressional Scorecard. It's a nonpartisan group that simply takes a look at our members of the Congress, our Senate, and our House, and their voting record, the causes they support, and how those votes and how those causes stack up to the Constitution and to, more essentially, to notions of liberty. This is a great way to check out where your congressmen are on liberty issues that I would argue, again, concern all of us, liberal and conservative. I say unwitting liberal because if they were wittingly liberal, they would probably be in favor of the anti-liberty positions. Someone is. After all, that's what's happening. Because, I would argue that liberalism as an ideology is anti-freedom. It believes in the nanny state. It worships the power of government, the great march forward to the international ant colony. You know, this dream of government as the redemptive force. And in the course of my conversation with Congressman Barr, I brought up two issues, the first being the increase in spying by the government, snooping, which is the ultimate dream of the left, public ownership of the means of communication. It's one of the definitions of socialism. This idea that every and all aspects of the life of the citizen can be known and controlled, therefore, and that you're basically living almost in an international concentration camp. Aldous Huxley made reference to this in his expose on the use of psychotropic drugs, where he said that such use resulted in a chemical concentration camp. Well, I mean, if the NSA and all of these other federal agencies and possibly sharing data with other international agencies can know every intimate detail about our lives from the moment we're born till the moment we die, then can they therefore not control us? They can control us by blackmailing us if we're doing something that is not politically correct. They can decide issues about us. And with this, the increase, for example, in the phenomena of the genomic mapping, which is by conventional terms a good thing, because it means that science will allow us to know what our genome looks like, which tells us whether or not we might have a propensity for various diseases, which is good. So we can treat those things. But the problem, like so much else, is that if this information enters into a database that is run by the government and that it goes into these massive facilities that are being built in Utah, then the government can decide what level of health care we may get. They can give us a Cory score, which is to say that if they nationalize health care further, they may not think it's worth spending any money if we have a genetic propensity toward a certain disease. Since we're going to die anyway, we're not going to be cured, so they will deny treatment. They can decide such things as who you marry, whether or not you're allowed to have children, because if you're going to pass on a gene that could result in disease, you could be denied a marriage license. Please don't think I'm kidding around about this. I mean, is that not the ultimate dream of the socialist movement? Was that not what happened and does happen in communist countries like China or North Korea? Certainly did happen in the Soviet Union, where they would have communist marriages and where they would, you know, the government would kind of get to decide, and certainly in China, how many children you have, and if you have too many, they can take you out as a woman and drag you out into the street and forcibly engage in an abortion, right? Population control. Very, very trendy among the left, especially before World War II, back when Nazism was viewed for what it was, a left-wing socialist movement. You know, this idea of creating a superior species, you know, eugenics, which emanates from Darwinism, very popular among left-wing establishment. So the greater control over information is control over people. And when it's done by governments, it's wrong. You know, it's, again, there's nothing wrong with the genomic science. It's good. But it is none of the government's business, your genomic map. Authorization of our federal agencies, and now that has been emulated by local police departments, which have also been more militarized, and what that could mean. I think it is a movement in general toward a national police force, which is what the Gestapo was in Germany. It's what the Cheka was in Russia. And it runs contrary to American notions of liberty and of constitutional law. In this country, historically, the highest ranking law enforcement officer in the land is the sheriff, the county sheriff, who is most often elected. And while we do have federal agencies like the FBI, which was founded in 1919, by the Wilson administration in response to the communist threat at the time, those agencies generally do not have police power. They're investigatory agencies that then use local policing when it comes to enforcement. That's generally how that's worked. So the phenomena of such agencies, including even the U.S. Postal Service, developing military arms. And this is not something that started with the Obama administration. It actually goes back, I think, to Clinton. But it's accelerating under Obama. is something that ought to be of concern to all Americans. They don't need this. We don't need a national police force. Our local and county police are perfectly capable of handling crime inside the United States. And if we have a situation where we have subversion, where we have, you know, dangerous cross-state drug gangs or whatnot, we have, you know, we certainly had a communist subversion, then there can be a national solution to it under Congress. But, you know, the national solution is not a national police force. I mean, Lincoln dealt with it during the insurrection, which, of course, is an extreme example. This is the issue of suicide. We'll be joined by Matthew D. Dovell, who is a suicide prevention expert. He's a Hollywood consultant. He's out of Las Vegas. And I want to talk with him about this, what I see as a growing phenomenon, if not an epidemic, of suicide, particularly among young people. Why are they committing suicide? What are they depressed about? What's going on with our young that they are so despairing that they want to end their lives? It says here that Matthew, he cracked the code for what causes depression, anxiety, PTSD, and suicidal thoughts in 2011. How to fix with self-help, bypassing stigma. So I want, this is, that word bothers me, but let's get to that. I mean, we'll ask him how this code has been broken. I mean, this seems to be a big thing, stigma, ending stigma. I notice that we've had this on with people who talk about ending stigma around mental illness. In my previous program with Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan, we interviewed someone who was advocating ending stigma around abortion. I generally think that stigma serves a purpose depending upon what is being stigmatized. I mean, I personally do not like to be stigmatized because I'm not on the left, and I am, because that's ignorant. You know, that's a squelching of legitimate conversations. But on the other hand, there are things that we're involved in that naturally result in a certain level of judgment. You know, we stigmatize, for example, people who are divorced, regardless of how it happened, because they're adults, they made the decision to go into a marriage and it failed. So when you're dating someone who's been divorced, yeah, there's a stigma. You wonder what happened. Las Vegas, and we are going to discuss the very grave and serious topic of what I view as an epidemic of suicides in this country, particularly among young people. Matthew, are you there? Okay, I think that he should be with us shortly. Hello, Matthew, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for joining. Great, thanks so much for joining me. Matthew, I did the introductions. You're a suicide prevention expert, Hollywood consultant. I want to talk with you a little bit about your work, but I want to discuss why you think it is that there has been, or at least there seems to have been, a major increase over the past maybe 10 to 15 years of teen suicides, of teen attempted suicides in this country. What is going on?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. One is the unemployment rate, the economic situation of our country, and the food. Quality of our food has decreased due to GMOs, pesticides, herbicides, sugars, preservatives, hormones, and antibiotics. They all affect our ability to think and process information correctly.
I think that's interesting in terms of things that might contribute, but I don't know if that fully explains why someone would reach such a state of despair, in this country of ours that they would want to end their own life. I mean, there seems to me to be something going on here in our culture, you know, that would result in this amongst students in our high schools.
Well, you have to understand what it takes to get to a point where you're bypassing your basic survival instinct, and to get to that point, because I know what it's like to get to that point, because I attempted suicide myself back in 1986. So I understand the process of how we get to a point as humans to where we find ourselves as the threat, and it's always the same, because I've been in this business since 86 of preventing suicides, and I know that what we're facing is a point where you're emotionally compromised, and the only way you seem to find a way out is to get rid of the problem, and at that point you think you're the problem. And so what we do is find some kind of method to do that. But what you're talking about is some kind of is there some kind of one thing that causes people to get to that point? And there is no one thing, because it's an individual. It's very individual why somebody would want to take their life. It could be a trauma from early childhood, or it could be something as simple as bullying, but it's a perceived threat, and it's always emotional, and it's very easy to fix if you know what you're doing. But when somebody gets to that point, if you're calling a suicide prevention hotline, the problem that we're having right now is that people say, well, let me get you over to a mental health expert, or we'll set up an appointment with a counselor. That's not what people need right now. They need somebody that can help them immediately. Because if you get to the point where you're able to get past where the stigma associated with a mental health problem, and you're able to call somebody and ask for help, then you need the help right then, immediately. And most organizations are not skilled or trained to be able to help somebody over the phone. And that's where we've been working for years, to get to that point where we're able to help somebody immediately with whatever issue they're having at that point. It's not the stigma is associated with mental health, because like Robin Williams, people have said that he was temporarily mentally ill. I mean, that's tragedy in itself, to be calling somebody who's suicidal mentally ill, because it causes other people to think, well, maybe I'm mentally ill, I'm defective. And there's quite a stigma associated with the word and mentally ill, because the image that comes to mind is The Shining, where he's at the door with an axe, and that's non-recoverable when you get to that point. But where you're at a point where you're going to self-harm yourself, that is recoverable. And we've developed methods mm-hmm. that you can do on the internet yourself without even contacting us, that are highly effective, that take less than 5 minutes. That's where we've been working.
Okay, I mean,
go ahead.
And I'd like to discuss those. The website, by the way, is My Last Breath. Is There Really a Heaven and Hell? My guest is Matthew Duvall. Matthew, I don't think that
it's a simplistic thing. Let me interrupt you just for a second, because that's a book I authored based on my two near-death experiences. One I drowned at 12, and one I attempted suicide at 25. But the important website to go to is supportisp.org, which is International Suicide Prevention, and that's where people need to go if they're contemplating self-harm. Okay.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I mean, and I don't mean to imply that I think it's a simplistic thing at all, or there's one answer to it. It's a very complex situation, as you say. Every individual is different, but at the same time, there does seem to be a major uptick in it, especially amongst younger people over the past 20 years. And I'm trying to take a look at this thing scientifically and ask, you know, and treat it in a sense like any other epidemic. You know, I view it as kind of it's similar to a disease. You know, if you have an increase in certain types of cancers, if you have an increase in certain heart disease, you take a look at what's going on in the environment, you take a look at what's going on in the culture. You know, a scientist tries to examine if there's been a change, because there's something that is new. I mean, there's something that's not the status quo. I mean, an example of like a lot of the violence in school, that didn't happen before. Whereas, I mean, it did, but not to the degree. There's been a major increase in it over the past 20 years. So you have to ask yourself, what is going on in the culture, or what's going on with these people that has changed? It's fairly documentable that there has been an increase in, you know, the things that you're talking about, you know, in that the sense of alienation and the sense of, you know, taking it out on oneself and all these things. I mean, that's always been there. What has changed to have resulted over the past, say, 20, 25 years in an increase in teen suicide and teen attempted suicide?
Well, like I said, the food has been changed over the last 20 years dramatically. With the introduction of GMOs into our culture, we've actually increased the pesticides and herbicides 100 times what they were with the food we used to eat 20 years ago. That is directly affecting the way we process and evaluate, the way we perceive issues like the economy. The economy has always been a factor in the suicide rates in our country or world history. When the economies are doing poorly, suicide rates go up because people don't see hope. And if you're a teenager or adolescent, you are more susceptible to your emotions, your hormones, the way you perceive your future. And if you're not eating correctly, or organics or non-GMO foods, I don't want to pick on GMOs, but I perceive them as a threat to our mental health, because, you know, you put A and B together and you get C, you have to quantify that and say, you know, we've introduced this new food into our system and suicide rates are going up. It's just like prescribing these antidepressants. I get calls all the time from people who say, you know, they're suicidal, and I say, are you on any medication? They say, yeah, I'm on antidepressants. I go, did you look at the bottle and see where it says, if you become suicidal while on this medication, you should stop taking it and call your doctor? Well, yeah, but I didn't think about that. Well, yeah, well, we need to call your doctor and tell him this medication's not working, because that was the point of it, was to stop you from being suicidal. So at that point...
No, I mean, look, by the way, I think you're bringing up a very important aspect to this picture, because if you take a look at, for example, the people who have engaged in the highly visible acts of violence in schools, the shootings, you know, the Columbines and all the rest, and also the ones that are not as widely reported that people know about on the state level, like here in Massachusetts, there have been several cases. In almost all of these cases, if not all of them, the person involved in the homicide, and it's usually a suicide also, often a suicide also, was on some kind of a psych drug. And that, you know, I think that since then there has been, the psychological establishment has pulled back a little bit in terms of giving these things out. But there was a while there where people were standing in line at school to get Ritalin and to get other drugs. And I think there is a direct connection between those drugs and both suicide and homicide.
Oh, I'm totally in agreement with you. I can't tell people to not take those medications, but what it is to me is you're treating a symptom. Suicide is a symptom of another problem, and we don't address the actual symptom because that's silly, because that's like having a jugular wound and you put a Band-Aid on it, but you don't stop the bleeding. It's still going to keep bleeding. So giving somebody medication for being suicidal is not going to fix the problem. All it's going to do is mask what's really going on inside, which is a trauma. Trauma is any event that takes place in somebody's life that is outside the scope of their usual life experiences. That's when that could be anything. It could be bullying.
Thank you very much. And my guest is Matthew D. Dovell. We're talking suicide prevention. He is a nationally known suicide prevention expert, Hollywood consultant. He's out of Las Vegas. Matthew, look, my goal here is to try to help my listeners if they might have these tendencies or if they may know people who have these tendencies to get help, to try to understand what's going on. That's why I'm examining it, and I'm trying to do so somewhat objectively. We've talked about the possibility of genetically altered foods as playing a role. I think that's certainly a possibility. We've talked about psych drugs playing a role. But these things, it seems to me, are more symptoms and not causes. I would think that I would suggest, and this is a sheer speculation on my part, but it's based on my own observations as the father of a daughter in public school and of knowing students in public school, that our public schools have become so oriented toward the absolute necessity of success and high grades and the pressures that are applied to young people to succeed. And, it's kind of divided between the smart kids and the stupid kids. The stupid kids, not much is expected, and they're not the ones that are committing suicide. The ones that are committing suicide are the smarter kids. And I think that it's partially because of this enormous pressure that they are under now with huge amounts of homework and just success for the sake of success. They don't know what it is to fail. And the other thing that I think has been going on in our schools for the past maybe 20 years is that there is no discussion about God. That's been completely removed from schools. It's all behaviorism. It's evolution, that they're nothing more than just animals evolving. It's all just, the content of education at the same time has been stripped away and has been replaced by behaviorism and, self-esteem learning and a lot of other garbage. And I think that and then there are specific methodologies in school that start very young, like phonics. It's been replaced by look say, which means that a young person, rather than learning how to read a word by learning vowels and consonants, they learn by guessing the word as if the word is a picture. So they have to memorize thousands of pictures. And the result is, I think, a dyslexia, an ADD, a dissonance in the mind. Do you think I'm onto something with any of this, Matthew?
Well, I'm always open to anything that's presented to me. And you are, I believe, onto quite a theory there. Because I have a child that's also in the fourth grade, and I am aware of what's being taught to him. But we homeschool our son because of he had problems with autism, so we decided to homeschool him, and we found that was based on the food that he was eating, and we totally went organic, and he has come out of that symptomatic mental health issue that they've presented to us, and he's a honor roll student. So, like I said, I'm a proponent of organics, and I know that these things are affecting our capacity to think correctly. I'm not just somebody talking about something I've read about. I've experienced it with my own children, and the way they're teaching our kids today is not something that I'm happy with, and the teacher-student ratio is impossible for a teacher to be able to reach every child, and there is enormous pressure put on the children that there is expectations for moving on to a higher level education. The number one symptom for a child or adolescent that is experiencing suicidal thoughts that is not on medication is apathy. It's the most overlooked symptom for a child that is contemplating self-harm.
Point in general, how to lessen suicidal tendencies among people. You mentioned nutrition. I think it's a very important point. In fact, if you're being advised to give your child, it's usually more males than females, things like Ritalin. Before you do anything like that, I would suggest that you take a look at their nutrition first. Take a look at what, whether they're healthy. And, you might find that some correction in nutrition will improve their mood and their behavior. I would think that resorting to a drug would be an absolute last resort. Matthew, what do you tell people when they contact the hotline? You say you've got methods for helping people deal with this problem. Talk about that a bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I've been working with the suicidal for almost three decades now, and it's very there's a pattern. I look for patterns in life, and with suicidal, it's always the same. First, I ask them what's going on, and they'll say, she left, he left, money's gone, whatever. I listen to that, and I most people just want to be heard, and once they express verbally what's going on with them, then they don't understand that there's not a lot of people that will listen to them without judgment, and they are a little more open to the fact that I've attempted suicide, and I make sure they know that, so they know they're not talking to somebody that's just went through schooling and learned about this. I'm experiential when it comes to overcoming the suicidal thoughts, which because I want to go back to where you were talking before. We are trying to erase God from our culture, which is a big problem with hope and the future for our children, because I died twice, and I met God, and I know he exists, and I know that there is something after this life. So I put that part of my message when I'm talking to people so they know that this is not all there is. This is not it. There's more that happens after this life. This is just a test run for our soul, and that there is a soul, and that we are more than just a machine. We have a soul that's in a machine, because our bodies are fantastic devices. So I believe that we need to teach that in our schools, that we know that evolution is nonsense, and we're still teaching that to our children, which is crazy to me. We've disproved the evolutionary theory over and over again, but we're still teaching this archaic belief to our children. It's like teaching a fairy tale to somebody. It's ridiculous to me. And to bring that out of our schools is criminal to me. To teach a child that one out of five teens has contemplated or admitted to contemplating suicide, that's a huge number. One out of five. That's 18%. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. And we need to address that in our schools. It's something we need. We're not teaching our kids how to cope. All we're saying is if you're having a mental health issue, we need to take you to the nurse, and then we need to prescribe you some medication so you're not feeling anymore. That's not a solution.
Right. That covers it up. I mean, you would think that in these times when, you know, look, I mean, with all of the problems that this country has, we're still a pretty successful, prosperous, happy society, that we would have such angst among our young people. You'd think that our selves, my guest, suicide prevention expert, Matthew, you know, look, I think we're kind of on the same page here with regard to describing what young people are up against and how this has contributed to the increase in suicide. The other aspect, of course, is this enormous pressure that's put on young people to succeed in a sense for the sake of succeeding, you know, the getting grades, without really integrating why it is that they're doing it. You know, they graduate from high school and from college. I know of one case, this young woman graduated from college. She happened to be Asian. She was super achieving, you know, high grades, you know, accomplished. She had become an MD, a doctor. You know, she was involved with all sorts of activities, extracurricular in her career. She had just gotten married, and 3 weeks later she committed suicide without anyone aware of what had been going on. Of why. There was no advance notice. And this kind of thing seems to be happening more, where someone just, you know, they just do it. I mean, there's this one case of a young man here in Boston who no one had any idea that he was suicidal. He was up the football team. He was, you know, well-liked at school, accomplished. And apparently he just... had been disappointed by one thing that had happened. Had gotten like a low mark on something, and he, you know, he walked in front of a moving train, left a note saying goodbye. Basically, I can't handle this this kind of rejection, this kind of defeat. So I mean, there's something wrong with the way we have things set up here that would lead to this kind of thing. What say you?
Well, again, that. The reason why people will mask the way they're feeling and the way they're perceiving the world around them is that stigma. Stigma is very powerful, and people will fear your judgment more than their self-preservation. The thing that I always ask people, you know, you can only judge things in life by one thing, and that's results. Back in 85, when I was doing a intervention on a Indian reservation, they had one, it went from one a day to one a month attempt, and no suicides over a 6 month period. So that shows that what I was doing was actually being effective. And so I started documenting what it was I was doing, and I put this down into a booklet called the Suicide Prevention Guide Booklet, SPGB, and this book was endorsed by mental health experts and doctors, higher level mental health experts. So the booklet is available online at our website at supportisp.org, and we started an initiative this last week, actually, for teen suicides. And what we plan to do was get the teens involved, because if you don't get them involved, nothing's going to happen, because the administrators are stuck in a rut, and they think that the methodology they're following, just like with the military and the vets, is the correct way to go. And to get any change initiated in that system is almost impossible. So I have to go in the back door and get the teens involved in producing a mental health procedure that they can do on themselves without the schools getting involved. And they're the ones who are responsible for this. So if there's a problem in your school, you can go on to a website and start an initiative in your school And through the process on our website, you actually will lower the suicide rates in your area by following the directions in the suicide prevention guide booklet that I authored. This is all available online. It's already in 8 languages. It's highly effective. There are 2 methods that are self-help that I've created. One's called 4-phase and one's called the EMR. And EMR is an emotional memory removal. So if you've had an experience where you've been bullied, rejection, ridiculed, experiencing racist oppression, sexual abuse, breakups, love abuse, inadequacies, unrealistic expectations been placed on you, have had failures, anything like those things that are symptomatic where you're experiencing desire to self-harm yourself, then you need to do the procedures that I've created that are available online for free and anonymous. And they do work.
Yeah, excellent. Can you talk a bit about those procedures, I mean, in a nutshell?
Well, in a nutshell, when somebody's suicidal, I ask them not so much about what's going on now, but how long have they felt this way? And they will generally say a week, a year, 5 years, whatever. Young adults, I don't like to call them adolescents or teens, they're young adults. They're just working their way into adulthood. So they are having problems coping. So I ask them, how long have they had this problem? And they'll say, whatever the time period is. And I'll say, what happened at the beginning of that time period? What happened 5 years ago? And they'll say, well, I got bullied. This guy punched me in the face in front of my friends, and I have a trauma now. And I'm like, okay, that's good. If you know when it started, then we could work on the problem, because that is the problem. And it's a domino effect. And the emotional, the actual memory components are sensory, which is your sight, sound, visual, taste, and touch. Those are your primary senses, and it's recording data whenever a trauma happens. And what determines your ability to remember that trauma is the intensity level of the experience. So you have this emotion attached to the data. What we do is we remove the emotion from the data permanently through 2 procedures, the EMR and the 4-phase. You do this yourself. It takes 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that trauma is permanently removed from
it. That's fantastic. I mean, what is it, just to relive it? I mean, what is it? What are those 2 procedures generally?
Well, the EMR is, yes, you relive the experience and you do the procedure and it deletes the emotion attached to that experience.
We'll be right back. I really appreciate it. We should do it again. Let my listeners know exactly how they can reach you, how they can get information about you and your group, and where they can get help.
Our nonprofit is International Suicide Prevention. We provide free assistance to anybody who's suicidal or post-suicide support, too. We believe that's a very important aspect of suicide prevention that's the most overlooked part of this. 80% of suicides, in-home suicides, are cleaned up by family members, which is a double jeopardy for the survivors and puts them in the highest risk category for future suicide. So we do free suicide scene cleanups for people who don't have insurance or money, which is extremely traumatizing to us. So we have to work our own procedures on ourselves. But it is something that is overlooked in our culture, and we perceive those who are survivors as somebody that's partially responsible for the victim, which is crazy in itself. But suicide support, ISP.org, and my website is mylastbreath.com. And we are starting an initiative to help teens empower themselves to overcome the suicidal thought process. without the stigma attached to it, which is very important for individuals like you've mentioned on your show already. And thank you for having me on as a guest. It's a very important topic, and we need to address this more and more so that it's not such a stigma in our culture.
Absolutely. And listen, I want to thank you very much for joining me, Matthew. We'll do
thank
it again
you
soon.
So much, Chuck. I'll do it again soon, as soon as you can have me on.
Thanks a lot. Okay, and pretty much that wraps things up for today. Check out my books on Amazon Kindle, Chuck Morse.
800-469-7591. 800-469-7591.